The Nobel Prizes have been awarded annually since 1901, but this is the first year that more than one woman has ever been honored with a science prize. Indeed, the class of 2009 includes four such distinguished scientists, and they're with us today to discuss the status of women in science. Hello, I'm Jeffrey Mervis with Science Magazine. Joining me by telephone are Carol Greider and Elizabeth Blackburn, who share the Physiology and Medicine Prize with Jack Sosek for their discovery of how chromosomes are protected by telomeres and the enzyme telomerase. Hello, Dr. Greider.
Hello, how are you?
Good. And Dr. Blackburn?
Hello.
Hello. Our third panelist is Ida Yonath, who shares the Chemistry Prize with Venkatraman Ramakrishnan and Thomas Seitz for her studies of the structure and function of the ribosome. Hello, Dr. Yonath.
Hello.
Yes, Dr. Yonath?
Yes, it's me.
Oh, hi. Welcome.
Hi.
And our fourth panelist, who we hope will be joining us, is Eleanor Ostrom, who shares the Economics Prize with Oliver Williamson for her analysis of economic governance, especially as it affects the commons. Joining us as well from our office in Cambridge, England, is Kate Travis of Science Careers. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Historically, women have been underrepresented in U.S. science. Although their presence has been growing steadily for the past three decades, many obstacles remain in the path of a young woman hoping for a career in science, especially in academia. So my first question to the panel is a simple one. What are the two or three most important steps that need to be taken right now to increase the number of women going into science and to improve conditions for those already in the field? And who should be responsible for making sure that those steps are taken? Anyone like to start?
It's a little bit like saying, can you solve the universe for us, please?
Okay.
That's a very large and important set of questions that you've phrased, and I think we're all trying to think about what exactly would be the most...
Sure. Maybe if I can prompt, are there some things that you've been involved in that you feel were successful and that you would like to see replicated and scaled up? And if so, you know, are they being scaled up? And if not, what are the obstacles?
Well, this is Elizabeth Blackburn of UCSF. Perhaps I could get the ball rolling, and I just only want to be the one to start and not be the one to continue too much. But the big bottleneck in terms of when women's advancement really starts to be seen to be actually more difficult is the transition from postdoctoral research, and I'm speaking about biological sciences, to the next career steps, you know, positions in academic or research intensive institutions. And so while women are very well represented in the PhD and postdoctoral levels, we see a strong attrition happening at the next important stage, the very important stage of applying for independent positions, especially in academia. And so the question is, how do you give people tools to deal with this? And one very practical thing I've seen at my institution, and I've seen it work there, but I know it's not unique to my institution, it's very common, having the ability for postdoctoral fellows to attend laboratory leadership courses. They can be as little as 1 week, and I've seen it in action with postdoctoral fellows, including at least some in my own lab, and I've seen how very effective this can be, because sometimes some of the obstacles are ones that very, very accomplished postdoctoral scientists are groping for ways to deal with, and in fact, there are very good ways out there. So there's one example, very practical, these leadership for people, you know, heading their own research group workshops. They don't waste a lot of time, and I've seen them be very effective.
I'm Ada. Can I talk?
Yes, please.
Elizabeth talked about a very important stage in the development of a scientist, a man or woman. They all have to be students and then postdocs. But I would like to refer to a step before that, actually a step before the PhD, and maybe even before the undergraduate. I think, in my opinion, although half classes today in life sciences and in chemistry are occupied by girls or by young women, only a few of them make it to the next and the next and the next after next step. And this is maybe because there is not enough intellectual leadership, enough effort made in making them appreciate science and love science and develop their scientific curiosity. I think that if we talk about role models and about the inspiration, this is lacking. And this is maybe because we, the established scientists, don't go to the youth and don't interact with the youth enough, either face-to-face, if possible, or at least by writing or by exciting them. So if a girl goes, many of them, I talk to them, and they said, yeah, I want to study this because I want to be afterwards a lab assistant or a research helper. Or very few say, because I want to solve a problem that interests me. And if there is a problem that genuinely interests a person, or if a person is ready, this is correct for men and women, if a person is ready to devote at least a part of life that has to do with science to a problem in science that they want to attack and hopefully solve, many of the other practical aspects will be, they will find a way to solve them.
Why do you think that is?
Well, that's what happened to me. Isn't it enough? I didn't have a mentor. Nobody told me go to postdoc. I just was very excited and curious about science and solved the things, the problems when they came up. Instead of thinking from the beginning and looking at science as a profession, I looked at science as somewhere that I go to satisfy my intellectual needs. And I found ways to bypass the day-to-day problems or issues.
Yes, I think that's so important what you're saying, because that's what we really hope for the young women coming into science who we see, you know, are so talented. And so the question is, how do we give them the confidence to go with that wish that they have? Because I think they find it very daunting sometimes. And as you say, Ada, there are all these practical problems. And the sort of confidence that people need to deal with those ideas that they will be problems, but that they are a good scientist and they should be somebody to go after the fascinating problems. I think that's where I see among people I observe the difficulty, that they love the science and they feel daunted at the same time. So how does one give them the confidence and the tools to be able to deal with those things that can end up deflecting them from the career that they might have wanted?
Do you think that there are organized programs that address that now or that should exist, either funded by the federal government or by a university or by some outside group, professional society perhaps? Are there ways of making those things happen?
Really good leadership courses. You know, very short and very well done. I don't know who runs them, but, you know, our postdoctoral association at our university put these, you know, they got these things together. And, you know, they're not giant bureaucratic programs. They're just very effective. I think ways of having people deal with certain aspects of these, you know, these many different challenges that will happen as one transitions from a training of a postdoc into an independent position of the kind that so many scientists want. So, yes, there's all sorts of ways, and as I say, they don't necessarily have to be, you know, huge.
And this is Carol. And I think that there's also a somewhat of a culture change that goes along with that, because, you know, in the past, there hasn't really been leadership courses and those kinds of more formal ways of informing oneself. And so I think that, you know, the current mentor people don't necessarily know to recommend that to their younger students. And there is a culture change going on. I certainly have seen it over the last 10 years of more focus on these kinds of tools that you can get to, you know, overcome any potential obstacles to be able to go forward and do what you're excited about. So I think that, you know, more understanding in sort of the cultural sense in all of us as scientists that these tools are very helpful to change the status quo would also be helpful.
Are there ways to help your colleagues recognize the importance of those things? Does it come down to getting a grant to run a program like that or having the dean or provost emphasize the importance of it? How would it actually work in practice?
Well, clearly people go to these courses in droves, so there's clearly a need there. I mean, that's what I see. These courses are, you know, well attended. The postdocs have seen the need in the postdoc associations, which often are supported institutionally, you know, can take initiative on these things. But leadership at the top and sending strong messages from the top, as we know, you know, from the high administrative levels, we know that's very important. And, you know, one would hope that that would be a big priority in institutions to make sure that that kind of, you know, both stated and implicit support is there for such things. Because, you know, I'm not even talking leadership as in taking high-level administrative positions, but even these sorts of courses deal with how do you lead your own research group? How do you deal with being a leader of your laboratory group, your grant, etc.? These things that are very much a concern of junior people, and I keep emphasizing that point because this is the point in the biological sciences when we lose so many women from the research career. And I don't like to use the word career. Career is more than a career. You know, it's it's something people, you know, very passionately do. And we lose people. I mean, we lose women at this stage after the postdoc in the biggest fractions right at that particular point.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ada was talking about earlier in the pipeline, going back, as you said, even, you know, undergraduate and high school and earlier. That's a different sort of problem. But I'm wondering if it's, you know, in some ways the same phenomenon in terms of providing incentives and opportunities.
So if I can answer, in Israel, we are doing it. The academicians in Israel set up an organization that goes to talk mainly to girls in high schools and in first college years and try to transfer to them the passion, the love to science. I'm doing it. I'm doing it almost five times a year, and I have a group of friends that it works. It works with them. Some of them came to study afterwards. Mm-hmm. Of course, what I'm doing as a one person and maybe this whole organization, another 100, this doesn't solve the whole problem, but it advances the problem. And I think that volunteering actions like this should be encouraged, not necessarily officially, but a lot by convincing the people that have to talk to the young ones.
Now, do you wish that more people like yourself was doing it? Is there a way to increase the numbers?
There is an organization. Even men are in this organization. And we do go to the young people or bring them to the lab. Bring like a group of 30 or 40 young people to hear a lecture, to have a look at the lab, to have a look at the facilities. And this is at the age of 17, 16, 18, something like that.
And what do they find most intriguing? What kinds of questions do they ask you?
Well, there are those that are talking about, are more intrigued about the personal aspect. So they ask, why did you do it and how did you do it and how did you solve that or that problem? And there are some that ask, so why was this the problem that interests you? I think it's very difficult to say that there is one type of questions, but I think that I can put them in two categories, as I explained earlier, the personal point of view and the intellectual point of view.
And do they feel that they can do what you can do, or do you think, look at you as someone who's up so high that they could never aspire to reach the kind of success that you've achieved?
First of all, I'm up so high only for a week, and I have been doing it for a few years. So until then, I was just another professor. But my life prior to be a scientist were quite difficult. I was an orphan, we were poor, and I didn't have any help. Actually, I had to help my family. Let's not talk about it much, but when the girls know it, they find out that if this could be done, maybe they can also do it. It's really like a role model from the younger age.
I wanted to...
Did I hear Eleanor join us?
Oh.
Yes, I just joined. I'm very sorry that late, but things here got delayed and... So that happened.
Excellent. No problem at all. Thanks. We're having a conversation, and I told people you would be joining us, so feel free to just jump right in.
Okay.
We were talking about, you know, trying to reach young students, women, and get them interested. And I wanted to ask Ada and Liz particularly about the UNESCO L'Oréal Award, but then all of you more generally. The two of you have received that award that honors exceptional women scientists. And I wondered if you felt that such gender-based awards are a useful way to draw attention to the accomplishments of women, or do they run the risk of pigeonholing your achievement as the best work that's being done by a woman?
I think they do a very important thing, which is good, which is, Ada, do you remember their logos? It goes something like, the world needs science and science needs women or something. How does that go?
Yeah, they have exactly this. That's correct.
Yeah, and the point is that any complicated endeavor like science, you need lots of different ways of thinking about things, and women probably do add ways of thinking about things that are scientific, you know, which may be different because of men, because there are cultural differences and so forth. Women bring, you know, a richness to the research in all fields, right, not just science, but women do bring extra dimensions. And so I think this idea that science needs women is really right on target, because I really think it is true that when you have people from different backgrounds, you know, a lot of studies show that if you, you know, have problems and you set a certain group of people who all have the same training and background to solve the problem, they'll all reach this sort of same bottleneck at the same time. But if you have a bunch of different background people, different training, different backgrounds, then they reach bottlenecks at different times. And so the ability to solve complex problems is greatly enriched by having different viewpoints. So anyway, I like what L'Oreal is doing, and if it runs the risk of pigeonholing, well, you know, that's the defect of the person who perceives it as that, because I think very much their message is not that. So, Ada, I don't know if you think that, but that was what I thought.
Well, I totally agree with you about the slogan, science needs women, and also about the reasons you think that the slogan is successful. I also want to highlight their additional contribution. It's not only the 5 women that get a prize every year, but also 15 fellows,
right.
Young fellows around the world.
Right.
And that's really very nice, and I was involved in the Israeli part of it because it's the first time that Israel implemented it, and it was a joy to pick up 2 or 3 fantastic young people. My little hesitation is, although everything is wonderful and the price is good and the slogan is good and they make everything very large and shouty, it's a bit too commercial. If it was less commercial and less emphasis on L'Oreal, 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 I think it would be more efficient. Because women, men also, but women associate L'Oreal with cosmetics. And the fact that it is mentioned so many times, and it's not only the ceremony, but before and after, for months, we have to go and talk about our science, but make sure we mention L'Oreal, I don't think it helps. I'm not sure I don't think, but I hesitate to say that it's good. From the other point of view, they contribute the money, so they have some say. I understand their motivation, but I'm trying to look at how it appears later.
Yes.
So I'm not sure we have to sit now and criticize or praise L'Oreal, but if you ask my opinion, it's too obvious, and a little bit less would be nicer.
Right, and UNESCO, which is the other half of it,
yeah,
seems to be less emphasized. And yet,
yeah, they're hardly mentioned.
It is incredibly important because, you know, that's the really important aspect to me is the UNESCO.
Mm-hmm.
That's the gravitas of the award is the UNESCO part, and it is a joint thing. But I agree with Ada. They don't toot their horn as much.
Now, that's a terrific slogan.
Did you notice that you asked us about L'Oreal? You didn't ask us about UNESCO.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you didn't ask. See, right away, that was very telling.
This was trivial right from the beginning.
Good point.
And it's not that I'm complaining, I'm just trying to improve.
Right. Now, the slogan is great, the world needs science, science needs women. Given that, and given, you know, the very, you know, common sense points that you both made earlier, how is it possible in this day and age for the director of the National Institutes of Health, for example, to launch a high-profile competition like the Pioneer Awards and wind up with an inaugural class of grantees that is all men? And what does it say about what it takes to address the problem when the next year, after there was an outcry, the second class is nearly evenly balanced by gender? Does that suggest that this is an issue that institutions can grapple with if they want to, but for some reason they don't think about, or it just doesn't get on the radar?
Well, since I called in late, this is Eleanor Ostrom, I'll address a little bit of that problem in more general terms. It takes a while for the acceptance of women in multiple disciplines. That's happening more and more, and I think 10 years from now, it will be a natural event that the distribution of women and men in the field does not represent the repression that women have faced in going to college or going into graduate school at an earlier juncture. So 10 years from now, I think we'll be fine. And it's the problem of how we get some of the transition there and having it brought to people's attention that, gee, why is it all male repeatedly is an important thing to do.
Do you have any thoughts about how to get through that transition period?
Well, we have in our program, we have about 50% women applying to go to graduate school. We have a very good entry class. I have a number of colleagues here at Indiana that are women who have full tenure. It's still not quite at the level it should be, but you don't make that overnight because taking and getting a PhD is a long process. And if women were not applying or were discouraged from applying, then they have not yet entered in enough numbers to be graduating in enough numbers, to be hired in enough numbers, to be making major breakthroughs. But it will happen.
At least speaking for the biological sciences, and perhaps to, you know, contrast a little bit with what might be the case in the world of economics, you know, the pipeline has been very, very strong for quite a long time for women. They've been populating the PhD and postdoctoral levels, you know, at about roughly half men, half women, for really quite a long number of years.
Oh, wonderful.
Yet, there's a very striking discrepancy in the careers after that. So I'm less optimistic that the problem is automatically solving itself, at least in these sciences, and I suspect other sciences too, by just the weight of numbers coming in. What we're seeing is a massive hemorrhaging, if we use the pipeline analogy, at this late stage after all these years of training and, you know, tremendous investment of talent. Then it's going off and sort of getting dissipated in other fields, which is nice for other fields, but not very nice for the aspirations, perhaps, of the women who, you know, really trained and put so much of themselves in training for so many years. So the question is, well, how do you, you know, how do you address that? And, you know, there are various Band-Aid sort of solutions that we've talked about, but I think career structures is something we have to look at, because for many women, the issue is one of the daunting idea of how am I going to have a family and a life and also tend to a career. And, you know, models in which there's potential part-time things which allow easy re-entry, that seems to me one route in which I've certainly anecdotally known good examples. Carol and I know somebody in the Netherlands, right, Carol, who was very successful in being part-time as her family grew old enough, and then when they got old enough, she's just gone roaring back full professorship. And, you know, so I really like to see those flexible models, and the examples that I've known about and can draw from, sadly, have not come from in the U.S.
Can I say something?
Sure.
There are still universities over the world and hospitals where women, scientists or MDs, have lower salaries. And even if it's not said directly, they are manipulated to take positions that are paid less or they have less possibility to advance. It's not many, but it's known. And it's not a pleasure to announce it, but it exists. And I think that in order to encourage women to go to science, medicine, or things like that, they have to know that they are appreciated and that there is an understanding that their salary has to be higher than of the men when they are married, and of course when they are not married and try to have families, which became now very popular, to have a one-parent family, and usually the one parent is a woman. And if this will be a policy that women at the same age, the same intellectual ability, and the same duties can get at least equal, but preferably more, and it doesn't have to be much more, but higher salary, this will be a big incentive, and also justice.
Now, I wondered, would people be willing to talk about when they decided to have a family, if they were faced with the choice of whether they would need to drop out or become part-time, and if they resented even having to face that issue, or how they dealt with it as they moved ahead in their careers and their families?
Well,
as a somewhat older participant, I had a clear decision and made a decision not to have a family, because in earlier times, that would have been a very, very difficult thing to accomplish.
This is Carol Greider, and I come from the other spectrum, and that I was able to see around me a number of women, including Liz, who were able to have children and have a career. And although there were many fewer women in the higher ranks of academia, there were still some to suggest that it could be done. So just in the same way that, you know, you have to go forward with experiments sometime, not knowing what's going to happen, just went forward with the experiment of, you know, having kids and the career and trying to do both full time.
Now, if I could follow up, Carol, you told the New York Times this week that having your children at your press conference was something that male winners wouldn't have thought to do. What message were you trying to send, and do you think it was heard?
I mean, I was somewhat misquoted by that. I mean, in fact, they were there, and that's because they were with me and I wanted them to be there. There was no intentional message I was trying to send. It's just that, you know, my kids were with me at home and I wanted them to be there for the day. And so, you know, in talking to some reporters, you know, they commented on that, but it certainly wasn't an intentional thing. It was just because I wanted them around.
This is Kate Travis from Science Careers. Ada, I saw you speak last year shortly after you received the L'Oreal UNESCO Award. This was at the European Platform of Women Scientists meeting. And you read to us a speech that your granddaughter gave, actually, at that ceremony. And I guess just on that theme, and Carol, with your kids being at the press conference, to what extent do you have to blend your personal and your professional life to achieve the balance?
When you ask this question, I understand that there is a question like this, but in my life, the day-to-day life, I don't think about this. It just comes. This is the way I am. And this is the way I run my life. And I don't really sit and organize myself. Tomorrow I have to do this or to do it here, or I don't look for an overall philosophy. It just happens. And I'm very happy that I have a very fantastic relationship with my daughter and granddaughter. Although I'm not what is called a normal mother, if there is something like normal mother, even in this, I have some doubts.
I think that the message of balance is somewhat overplayed in my view, because if you're doing something intense like having a family and doing science, they're both intense things. And so this idea that somehow every day is sort of balanced, I think is really a bad message actually to try and send people. If you really love what you do and you love, you know, your family time, which we, you know, clearly do, then we want to do them very intensely. And I think balance, I like to tell people that you can have balance over your life, but think of it over decades. Because, you know, for some, you know, decade or so, at least a decade or so, if you're having children, they're going to be very intense aspects of your life, which are to do with research and to do with children. But later on, you get to go to the movies and the restaurants and before the children, you know. So we have decades of professional life ahead of us, if we're fortunate. And those are not all occupied by children, and yet I think many young women are daunted enough at the stage when it's, you know, the right stage for them to be having children. Biologically speaking, it makes sense to have children at, you know, relative early age. Mine was actually later, but in the case of most people, they want to have, you know, a child when their childbearing years are there, and they or children, and then they're very daunted. How am I going to manage this? And it's sort of hard to think ahead to the idea that actually the children will grow up and you still have years of productive, you know, exciting scientific life ahead of you. So I try and send the message, for goodness sake, don't go for balance. That sounds very boring to me, you know, in the sort of, you know, is it 9 to 5 and you're balancing your life? Go for these things intensely in the periods when you have to go for them. And, you know, the balance will take care of itself over decades.
And this is Carol. I'd just like to also add, I mean, I agree with everything that Liz said, but this isn't something unique to women scientists. You know, many professional women face this kind of issue about, you know, the time that they have with their family versus at work. And actually, I have found, and I tell people when I go around and talk to women students, that it's actually very nice to be in science because, you know, what we're judged on in the end is, you know, how productive we are and what we get done, and it's not necessarily 9 to 5. And so I feel like I do have a lot of freedom. You know, I'll go out for my son's play at school at, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon and then come back again. And that kind of freedom to have a flexible schedule, I think, is not always true in other professions. So it's a reason for people to choose science over some other careers that they might have.
Actually, that's paradoxically, yeah, it's probably the best career if you want to combine it with a family.
Yeah.
Because of the autonomy and in, you know, the situations where you are able to be, you know, leading your own research group.
Now, that's an interesting perspective because I've read reports that have said women in particular go out of academic science because they're looking for more regular hours. They're looking for a more predictable schedule. But yet, I think you both made a convincing argument to the opposite.
Right. People have been giving them bad information. I think there's a lot of conventional ideas about what it should be to be a mother. And, you know, certain sorts of formulae and stereotypes are there. And I really think that they're not terribly helpful, some of these ideas, because I really think, you know, children of busy scientists do get family lives that are perhaps different in some ways, but not the less good.
That's a great point. And I think one of the other points that we hear a lot in the science career space is just an issue of time. And this isn't unique to just women. Men have the same pressures, but similar pressures when it comes to time, family demands, teaching, grant writing, doing their research. Has there been anything for any of you that's really helped you be successful in terms of managing your time?
It's time for me to tell the Bagel Bites story.
Oh, sounds interesting.
Well,
please
do tell.
Producing beautiful cookies, or, you know, cupcakes with beautiful icing, and you're up till 2 a.m. making them for your children, right? This is what motherhood is supposed to be like, right? You produce this wonderful, you know, you're supposed to cook these very detailed things for your children. Well, it turns out that if you go to your freezer in your supermarket, you can buy these little bagel bite things, they're called commercially, and you put them in the oven and they bubble, you know, cheese on the top, and they bubble and they're lovely and brown and, you know, taste wonderful. And you take them to any children's function and the children swarm over them, they eat them, they love them, and you're a huge success. You know, you're a mother who's brought the favorite dish and it takes 12 minutes in the oven to cook. So my feeling is deploy your time. You know, you try and think of ways to deploy your time well and yet sort of catch the essence of what is it that is, you know, that people like mothers to do. But you don't have to do it in a very laborious, conventional way. You can get creative. I think as scientists and in many professions, you know, the one thing we're good at is we're good at solving problems. We really are. So we need to think of, well, okay, what's a good way to solve the problem of meeting some of these expectations of motherhood? So I kind of joke about this, but actually I'm very serious. It's probably saved me, you know, cumulatively hundreds of hours to have this very, you know, quick and easy dish that you can bring to gatherings, because many, many times our children are going to gatherings and you need to contribute something.
Well, I have to ask, how did you discover the bagel bits?
I can't remember. Are they bagel bits or bagel bites?
Bagel bites.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I know them well.
I can't remember their moment. But let me tell you, you know, the triumph of finding out that they worked in preschool and then they continued to work in kindergarten and then through elementary school and then the last year of high school, you know, all the sophisticated San Francisco high school, you know, palettes, our children's contemporaries, you know, they just fell on these things still. So in other words, what I'm saying is that it does take creativity in a way to try and solve all these problems of, you know, trying to have a family life and have a science life. And so you have to think about, well, what will really save you some time?
Carol, I read on the Hopkins website that you gave up triathlons after you had your children. Is there anything else that, any other ways that you shifted priorities to make sure that everything got the right amount of your attention?
Well, I didn't give up the exercise because that was extremely important for my own self. And that's, I think, something that's very important is to, you know, make time for yourself. I was just a little bit afraid being out on the roads with so many cars that, you know, if I was hit by a car, then it's different if you're a mom than you're not a mom. So now I do this indoor biking or these spin classes and running and swimming instead. So no, I didn't feel like I just kind of shifted rather than giving something up.
Now, several of you have been presidents of your professional societies, and I wanted to ask you, not just while you were president, but more broadly, is there a bigger role that professional societies can play in this issue? Do you think they've been effective? If not, what have been the obstacles, and what would you like to see happen that would improve the situation?
Well, I think that Liz is the one that has been president of many societies. Maybe you can...
Well, I've been president of the American Society for Cell Biology, and I'm president-elect of AACR, so my experience is limited to one so far.
Okay. Well, I know Eleanor has also been president, so I hope she'll have something to say.
Yes, I think it is important. I've been president of several, so I think it's three or four. I can't. Public Choice, the American Political Science Association, the International Association for the Study of Common Property, and each of them give you an opportunity to discuss your scientific interests, but you go to many different meetings, And it does certainly make it more apparent that women are making a real contribution to science when they're chairing, when they're making presentations, when they're going to regional meetings, when they're on appointing people for the committees, things of this sort. So, yes, I think the professional associations have all played a very important role.
Liz, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
I don't think I could have said it better. Exactly. I really agree.
Now that you, as Ada said, even if it's only for a short time, now that you have this visibility and a bully pulpit, are there things that you think you can make happen to increase federal support, government support for women in science, increase societal awareness of the importance of attracting women into science that you couldn't have done previously? And do you have any plans to do that sort of thing?
Well, this is Carol, and I think just, you know, getting out there and talking to people with the opportunities that have come up does, you know, two things. It puts science into the minds of the public in general. You know, the more you go out and talk with various media outlets, it's not often that we hear about science in the news, in the general public news. And so it's an opportunity to do that. And then by simply being a woman scientist, it puts that in the public eye as well. And I don't think there's necessarily so much that has to be said. If you just have the opportunity to be there and talk about your science, it makes a statement.
Other thoughts from anyone?
Yeah, I think we're a very visual species and very visual culture, and just, you know, being there, the fact that the face of science now, you know, is seen to have women, and women who are seen as successful as judged by this Nobel Prize, that sort of just sends a message in and of itself. So I think that is important, again, from this point of view of making sure that, you know, women do feel that science is a career for them.
Now, will you be disappointed if next year's awards and the year after do not include women? I realize this is one data point, I think, Carol, as you had said in one interview. But on the other hand, it seems like a striking difference to go from 1 to 4. Would you be disappointed if that didn't continue?
Well, we'd like to see the biological ratio, right, which is 50-50. 50-50. And so all we're doing this year, I would say, is just approaching a more normal situation in terms of the biological ratio. So you're saying, is this just a flash in the pan? Is this just a once-off and then things will be different? And so I suppose you have to look at the fluctuations of small numbers and say, well, what expectations do you have over, you know, 10 years? What do you expect to see? If you hope that there would be roughly equal men and women, then that number will fluctuate somewhat from year to year. I wouldn't sort of do your question that way. I'd like to do the next 10 years trend, because I think then statistically you'll see something more.
Sure. Eleanor, could you address the situation specifically in economics and political science?
We wouldn't expect that every year from now on that we would have one woman and one man receiving the prize in economics. That'd be wonderful. But over a period of time, over a decade, as was discussed, that we begin to approach 50-50 makes eminent good sense. And if it doesn't, that is something we can be addressing. Why are women who are making major contributions not being recognized?
How would you address that in the context of the Nobels?
Well, it's a delicate problem, and we can address it more generally than just Nobels. But indeed, if 10 years from now, if I were still alive and kicking, and the ratio had gone way, way down, and someone asked me, I would be very honest and frank and say I was deeply disappointed, because I know there are very able women out there who aren't being recognized.
Would it say something about the process of recognizing scientific achievement?
Well, I think it says something about the processes that have been very much in academia. As a person who was strongly advised against going to graduate school because I was a woman, I'm at least relieved that that has stopped. And slowly but surely, we are seeing many more women being into full professors, being given awards, etc. I think we will be seeing a continuation of that. But if we don't, then we better speak up and indicate that something's wrong, because we now have many women who are very capable in the field. They're doing exciting work. They're just being ignored.
And Ada, if I could ask you, in chemistry, you were the first woman in 45 years. What do you think the prospects are?
I hate to cut the common way everybody talks. Until now, almost common. In my opinion, it's very nice that women get it, and it's very nice that there is half-half this year. It was not very nice that the community had to wait 45 years for a woman, but the prize should be given for excellence and not pay attention to anything else, no gender, no color of skin, no geography, nothing, just excellence. And if there is an excellent woman, she should get it. She should not be discriminated against, but also not discriminated for. So I would be a much stronger against any other consideration but excellence.
Right. No, I'm sure everyone would agree. But what I was hearing from people is that there are excellent, brilliant women scientists, and the record shows they're not being honored.
That's correct. There are also many good male that are not being honored. It's just one prize for the whole world. And how the committee in Sweden make the decision is above and beyond my understanding. Yet, I don't think that the gender has to be of any of their consideration. They should make their decisions. Not always they make it the way I would have made, but I wouldn't get gender into these parameters that they look at.
I agree with that.
Right. I don't think any of us would suggest at all that that should be the case. I think it's, as Ellen was saying, that the processes that have been operative in academia have rather militated against women ending up being recognized for accomplishments.
Okay. Well, let me just throw out one last question to all of you. We've touched a little bit on this, but I was hoping that maybe you could expand. The next time you have a chance to talk to a 12-year-old girl who shows a passion for science, what do you most want her to know about what lies ahead of her, the opportunities, the obstacles, and anything else?
Well, I was just talking to a group of 9-year-old girls that were interested in science. I went into my daughter's school, actually, and they asked me some of those questions. And what I said was, do what excites you. Follow your passion. Don't necessarily worry about what obstacles might be there, because there are always ways to overcome them. But the most exciting thing is to be able to do what you love and just don't let anything stand in the way of that.
Now, if I recall that you said that was advice that you had received from your father.
That's similar to the advice, yeah.
So it's still true today.
Still true.
Do others want to comment?
I think that captured it very well. If you don't choose to do what you really fascinated and want to do, and then you prepare yourself and get yourself ready to do it, then your life is not a very worthwhile life.
Anyone else? Well, if not, I want to thank all of you. I really appreciate your being here to explore this issue on such short notice and with such a busy schedule. So congratulations to you all.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
For Science Magazine, I'm Jeff Mervis.
And this is Kate Travis for Science Careers.
And we'll say goodbye. Thank you all.
Yes, thank you very much, and congratulations to you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.